And when it says in Genesis, for 6 days God creates, the seventh day he stops. He's basically focusing on his work of redemption on the seventh day. And suddenly it made sense to me. You know, a lot of astrophysicists believe in God. Not too many field biologists believe in God. Here's the difference. The astrophysicists are looking back before the human era, because it takes light time to reach them from those distant galaxies. So they're seeing the creation during the 6 days. The field biologists, they're doing their research on the seventh day. So they say, we see no evidence for God's supernatural handiwork in creation. Obviously, they're looking on the wrong day.
I was reading your book recently, and I realized there will never be enough time. I want to ask you so much, because we were together in New York recently, and I just thought, we need many, many hours. So we'll do our best. But thank you for joining, and thank you for being in the film.
You're welcome.
You're better than the other guys in the film. I just want you to know. Way better. Wait, John Lennox, nah, he's not that good. He's no big deal. But I mean, in all seriousness, the problem with a lot of this, and I'll start here, communicating these things, it can be difficult, communicating them on a popular level, because you want people to understand, but you're talking about difficult things. I mean, most people don't remember what is redshift and blueshift, and what does that mean? So I just want to thank you for spending decades helping us, people like me, understand what I think many of us didn't even hope we could ever get answers on, you know? So I guess I want to start tonight with your most recent book, which is called Noah's Flood Revisited. Now this, I just think, what is the most... you say this in the beginning of the book, that if you're talking to somebody who doesn't believe in God or they think the Bible is garbage, probably they'll go to Noah's Flood first. And I remember, again, around 1990, discovering your stuff, and you're talking about it in a way that I just thought, wow, this is kind of amazing. So let's start, at least briefly, with your journey. What is your story? In other words, how did you find your way into faith, in whatever it was? Where did you start?
Well, I started when I was 7 years of age, grew up in Canada, didn't know any Christians, but I was on the autistic spectrum. I wasn't talking until I was seven.
Were on the autistic spectrum, but they
still
fixed
am.
That? They fixed that?
No. Still am. But when I discovered books, it just changed everything. So starting from the age of seven onwards, I was reading 4 or 5 books on physics and astronomy every week, and knew at age 8 astrophysics would be my future career.
Are you still brainy, or was it just at that time? Okay, go ahead.
Well, what happened was...
Because most of us only read maybe one book on physics a week at that age. But you're reading 3 or 4.
Yeah, right.
That's.
So, and it was at age 16, I spent a year studying cosmology, which you saw in the film, The Origin and History of the Universe, and recognized that the evidence was heavily favoring Big Bang cosmology. It was refuting the steady state. It was refuting the oscillating universe model of Hinduism. And so I said, if the universe has a beginning, there has to be a cosmic beginner. I want to find that cosmic beginner. Had no idea where to look.
At age 16, this clicked for you.
It
that if the universe has a beginning, what we talk about here,
right,
that it implies a creator,
right,
and I'm interested in if I can figure that out.
I want to find who that is. So, and didn't really know where to look, but I said, Immanuel Kant's the father of cosmology. I'll read his Critique of Pure Reason.
Who
read it?
Who wouldn't do that, right?
Yeah, right.
we've all read Kant at 16, but no. So you said he's the father of cosmology. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
you knew that at 16.
About
you're making us feel real stupid, Hugh. Please continue. Please go
well,
ahead.
Well, I realized he had the wrong concepts of space and time, so I need to look elsewhere. I read a few other philosophers, René Descartes and several others. And then I was going to a high school in British Columbia that was 90% Asian immigrants. And they said, oh, you got to read the Hindu Vedas. So I read them and said, oh, this is where the oscillating universe model comes from. The universe reincarnates itself. And I told my fellow Hindu friends, look, the latest science tells us there's no way that's true. the universe cannot possibly reincarnate. There's way too much entropy in the universe. So then I looked at Buddhism, looked at the Quran, looked at Zoroastrianism, and finally I picked up a Bible. Now, I did know or got to see two Christians when I was 11 years of age. They came into our public school, put two boxes on our teacher's desk, and didn't say a single word. But in those boxes were Gideon Bibles. So I began to read that Gideon Bible and immediately recognized this book is different. It gets all the science right. I mean, I started on Genesis 1.
So how old were you at this point?
17.
Okay, now when you say you're reading the beginning of Genesis and it gets all the science right, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God creates the universe, the heavens and the earth. There's no Hebrew word for universe, but they have this phrase, the heavens and the earth. And so I said, okay, then we get into earth. And I said, the point of view changes from the universe to the surface of the earth. And from that frame of reference, the 10 creation events described in Genesis 1, I knew were all in the correct scientific chronological order, and they're all correctly described. The best I found outside of the Bible was the Enuma Elish that got 2 out of 14 right. All the other creation texts scored 0. Here's a book getting 10 for 10 on the creation events and 4 for 4 on the initial conditions. And I knew that was way beyond the science of Moses. He had to have help from the one that actually did the deed. So I said, this book actually might be inspired by the creator of the universe. And I began to spend an hour or two a night studying the Bible between midnight and 2 in the morning, because I knew my parents wouldn't approve. So I did it all secretly.
So your parents weren't approving of your journey?
No.
And why? Why?
Well, they did believe in the morality of the Bible, but they didn't think there was any such thing as God. I remember my mother thinking that the Trinity was a mathematical impossibility. So they were very dismissive of Christianity and all religions. But as I began to read through an hour or two a night, and I basically noticed the Bible encourages testing. Test everything. Hold fast to that which is good. So I began to test all the scientific statements in the Bible, all the historical statements. It took me 18 months to get to Revelation 22. And when I did, I realized there's large sections I don't understand. But what I do understand, it gets all the history right. It gets all the science right. It predicts future scientific discoveries hundreds of times. And I remember at age 19, calculating the probability that the Bible would get all these scientific predictions correct. And the probability was less than 1 chance in 10 to the 300th power. And I'd just been given a problem in my physics class of calculating the probability that one of the 600 students in our class would be killed by a sudden reversal of the second law of thermodynamics. That's 1 chance in 10 to the 80th. Such a tiny possibility, you know, it's never going to happen anytime, anywhere in the universe. But it showed me, I had just demonstrated that the Bible is 10 to the 220 times more reliable than the second law of thermodynamics. And I have to give credit for the Gideons. They based on the Bible they gave me had 2 pages in it. This is what you need to do when you become convinced this is the inspired, inerrant word from the creator of the universe. And so they basically explained how the creator came as a human being and lived amongst us for a few decades. And that gave us a demonstration of the moral life he expects us to lead. So I remember at age 19, at 1:07 in the morning, signing my name in that Gideon Bible, committing my life to Jesus Christ. And I still carry that Gideon Bible around with me.
You're kidding.
It's right here. This is that Gideon Bible that brought me to faith in Jesus Christ. Our dog
so
chewed the cover off.
I didn't carry a Bible, I feel naked. That's amazing. That's amazing that you have that. Thank
you.
No,
it's
you
a treasure. I'm going to keep it. Yeah.
My goodness. Well, I mean, what I find you very delightful and to some extent fun, unintentionally funny, because you are so logical. There's something so beautiful about your following the logic and the story of you at that age following the logic. There's just something beautiful about that. And I don't know if you dreamt at the time that you would be decades in the future helping millions of people follow the logic, as you did me. I mean, I remember it must have been 90 or 91 when I was reading. What was the book that you had? It was The Fingerprint of God. The Fingerprint of God. And I guess I was looking for, you know, I knew I had come to faith and I knew that was real, but I thought, okay, so what can I know? What are the limits of what I can know or what I can talk about or what I can understand? And reading just that book, I was really astonished to think that someone of your caliber had been looking at this. And you look at it, and it's true in this book as well, you really don't, and I think this is very important, you don't have a dog in the fight. You're just looking for what is true. What can we know? Mm-hmm. You're not worried the way Einstein was about, well, we've got to protect our paradigm. My paradigm says there's a God, so I've got to keep it. You're just, you have a freedom in just exploring. Let's just see what we can figure out. And I think, again, there's so much, you've written so many books, but I want to talk about this book because this is really the flashpoint for a lot of people. A lot of people just like, hey, listen, talking snakes, that's insane, and Noah's Ark, that's nuts. And I have absolutely never encountered anyone looking at it as coldly as you do, as bloodlessly, in the best sense of that. And I didn't even think that that was possible. And so today, as I was going through the book again, I thought, I'm just dying to talk to you about this, because I know most people like me just can't imagine that you could have any kind of a logical, substantive conversation about this. It's just too long ago, it's too difficult, and it just seems so mythical, and, you know. So I guess I remember reading, it must have been around 91, where you throw out the idea that there are things we assume, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian or whatever, we all assume the Bible says this and this and this and this, and you basically say, no, maybe it doesn't. This is an interpretive issue. So I think there are a lot of people that they just say, well, the Big Bang can't happen because we know, well, the Bible says that the universe is, you know, 7 or 8,000 years old, and so that's that. You kind of look at the Bible on its own terms. And I remember when you talk about, you know, it says, you know, God creates the earth in 6 days. And you have a high respect for Scripture, but you say, well, but it doesn't mean 24-hour days, or it needn't mean that. When did that occur to you? Because there's some people that are very rigid about that, and they would say, you're slipping away by interpreting it that broadly. What do you say to those folks with whom you've had many conversations?
It happened to me the first time I picked up the Bible and gave it a serious read. At age 17, went through Genesis 1, noted it talked about these 6 creation days. Each of those first 6 days end with an evening was, morning was phrase. I didn't know what the Hebrew words for evening and morning were, but I knew at a minimum they were saying each of these days has a start time and an end time. You get to day 7, there's no evening, morning phrase, which implies we're still in God's 7th day. And my approach to the Bible was, I'm not going to make an interpretive position until I read through the entire Bible. When I got to Psalm 95, it explicitly states we're still in God's 7th day. Hebrews 4 states we're still in God's 7th day. And when it says in Genesis, for 6 days God creates, the 7th day he stops. He's basically focusing on his work of redemption on the 7th day. And suddenly it made sense to me. You know, a lot of astrophysicists believe in God. Not too many field biologists believe in God. Here's the difference. The astrophysicists are looking back before the human era because it takes light time to reach them from those distant galaxies. So they're seeing the creation during the 6 days. The field biologists, they're doing their research on the 7th day. So they say, we see no evidence for God's supernatural handiwork in creation. Obviously, they're looking on the wrong day. They're looking on day 7, not the first 6 days. So I always felt these days had to be long time periods because we're still in God's 7th day. The other thing that caught my attention, Day six says that God creates the human male and the human female. But you get to Genesis 2. God creates Adam first. He's outside the garden. God puts him in the garden. He watches the trees grow. Now he tends the garden and keeps it the way God had given it to him. Then God says, I want you to examine all these soulish animals and give them appropriate names for how they relate to you. And each of these animals relates to us humans in a different way. So Adam did all that. Then you've got God commenting. He looks down on Adam and says, this guy's lonely. And so what does he do? He puts him to sleep, performs surgery on him. Adam recovers from the surgery. He sees this creature, Eve. What comes out of his mouth? It's hapa'am in the Hebrew, used 20 times in the Old Testament, consistently translated at long last. So it's like the sixth day, likewise, is a long period of time. I mean, I joke, it takes men more than a few minutes to feel lonely. So
that, I mean, again, this is what I love about your stuff, is like you're perfectly logical. And I find it funny how irritated many Christians can be with you, because you're saying things that rattle them. They've been told, no, you must believe this. It's very clear. And you're saying, no, it's not clear. In fact, the evidence says that it's got to be longer than 24 hours.
Well, for example, the flood account is the number one reason why people reject the Bible as the inspired and inerrant word of God. That's why I wrote the book. If I can get them past the first 11 chapters of Genesis, it's pretty easy to get into the book of John and into a relationship with Jesus Christ. But Genesis can be a stumbling block. And so what you see in the book is there's way more content on Noah's flood outside of Genesis than in Genesis. So it pays to read what the rest of the Bible's got to say about Noah's flood. You know, people wonder, why this ark? Well, the New Testament, and only the New Testament, tells us God raised up Noah to be a preacher to his generation. So one of the purposes of the ark was to serve as a pulpit to attract attention and get people to listen to his message of repentance. God always sends a prophet before he brings judgment. And even at age 17, I realized this flood, according to Genesis, lasts a whole year. For it to last that long, something has to replace the liquid water that would flow quickly out into the ocean, which told me this has to be an ice age event. Only during an ice age would you have sufficient melting ice to replace the water from the 40 days and 40 nights in the underground aquifers that would flow out into the ocean in a matter of a few weeks. The flood lasts a whole year. Now, if it happens during the ice age, now you begin to remove some of the genetic contradictions. I mean, the problem why people think the flood account is nonsense, they think it's 5,000 years ago, they think it's global.
And okay, that I remember reading that in your book, again, probably way back, that you said, and anybody who's going to be familiar with your work or read your work, you don't speak sloppily, you don't throw stuff out, you give all the evidence. And I remember you're saying in the book that the flood was not covering the whole of the planet. That was the first time I'd encountered that thesis. So what do you call, you say that it's not extremely local, but what's the term that you use?
I use the term worldwide. It's not a local flood. It's not a global flood. It's a worldwide flood. And I have a chapter in the book where I look at all the places in the Bible where it talks about a worldwide event. 100% of the time, it's less than the whole globe. So, for example, you've got Joseph feeding the whole world. And if you read a few verses on, he fed everybody in the Egyptian Empire in the land of Canaan. He wasn't feeding the people in New Zealand. He was feeding the world of the Egyptian Empire. Or when you got Paul saying in the Roman Christians, your faith has been heard throughout the whole world, he meant the Roman world. He wasn't claiming the Aztecs in Mexico were hearing about.
Okay, so you say that the Bible says it was the whole world, but that doesn't mean it covered the globe. And in this book, you really get into this, and this is what's is just delicious to me. It's so delightful that you even the way you use the Bible to explain the Bible, that, you know, it says in the days of Augustus Caesar, that, you know, there'd be a census so that all the world
will be taxed.
Would be taxed.
Yeah.
That's just the Roman Empire, but it says
right.
all the world. Okay,
right.
So when you say that it was a worldwide flood, what is your best guess on the limits of this flood?
Okay, 2 Peter 2 says the world of ungodly people was flooded. All the ungodly people plus all their animals. But I think the real key is Genesis 10 and 11 talks about God scattering humanity from the flood region into all the places of the world. I intended to write this book a decade ago, but I said, I know science is going to give us really good dates for Genesis 10 and 11. So I waited until all
that stuff. You're talking about the Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel, where you got people building a big city and a big tower. Why? So that we will not be scattered over the whole face of the earth. God knew that was a prescription for the return of widespread evil. So God forcibly scatters humanity into all the land masses of the world. Now, for the first time, we got scientific evidence, four independent ways
of dating. Within the last decade.
Within the last 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So I basically.
Lucky for us.
Well, I waited for that to be published. Said, now I can use this to nail down Genesis 10 and 11. And if we got that, then Noah's flood must predate Genesis
okay.
10 and 11.
Now you're going to shock some people. So what is your best guess at when the Tower of Babel occurred?
Well, what we can determine is when the great scattering happened.
Okay, and then, and when you say we, you mean scientists.
Scientists,
okay.
yes.
Okay, and what do they say?
40 to 50,000 years ago.
Okay, so the Tower of Babel, according to
been,
your best guess, would have been 40 to 50,000 years ago.
A little bit before that, because
okay.
the scattering happens after the Tower of Babel.
Okay. And you're saying that just before, sometime before that is Noah's flood.
Correct.
Okay, so that's challenging for most people, I think, to think of human civilization that far back. I mean, that challenges me. I think, wow, what? And I'm not that I disagree, because I don't ever disagree with you, because I trust you, having read a lot of your stuff. But it is a challenging thing to think like, my goodness, there was enough civilization 50,000 years ago that they were building a great tower or whatever. I mean, I can imagine, you know, conceivably 5,000 years BC, but that's difficult.
Yeah, this book came out in October, and I told our team, hold the presses, because there's a paper being published I have to cite, which was a discovery of big, thick, long pieces of rope that dated back more than 40,000 years ago that they found on the southern Indonesian islands, indicating that humans at that time were building large wooden boats to cross that piece of ocean from Indonesia to Australia. And we got evidence that Australia was settled 40 to 50,000 years ago, which tells us building a big wooden boat like you see with Noah's Ark, we got evidence that goes back at least 40,000 years ago.
That's in my notes to ask you about shipbuilding knowledge 50,000 years ago, because you mentioned that in the
right,
book.
Right, right.
But this is wild stuff. This is the kind of stuff, you know, Joe Rogan talks about this stuff. We don't. But now we do. Again, it is challenging. I think it's challenging to anybody, not people who profess Christian faith, but anybody to think of civilization that ancient. Okay, we can imagine cave paintings 40,000 years, you know.
Well, let me give you another example. What we just discovered recently is that early humans were harvesting grains, they were grinding them, roasting them, and boiling them. And that goes back at least 40,000 years ago in Europe alone, and even earlier in Asia. And we now know why. Humans lack the anatomy to survive on raw food. Even Adam and Eve had to be cooking their food. We can't get the calories and nutrition we need if all we do is eat raw food. We don't have the jaw muscles. We don't have the jaw anatomy to make that happen. Neanderthals did, but they were spending 4 to 6 hours a day chewing their food. We get through our food. I watched my sons. 10 minutes a day, they got all the calories they need. So, and the interesting thing is, we actually talk while we eat because we're eating soft food. So we can engage socially while we're eating. You watch the great apes, when they eat, that's all they're focusing on. they really can't engage socially when
they're
eating. You're
saying they never talk?
Well, they do, but not when they're eating.
Oh, okay. So, there's so much here. Can you see, like, I'm tempted to go down rabbit holes, and I can't because we don't have the time. I want to ask you about Neanderthals. I want to ask you about... We'll do a lightning round. Okay. So you believe that the Tower of Babel is like 40, 50,000 years ago. When do you suppose the flood happened?
Okay, good question. We now have really good temperature records of the previous ice age, and we recognize there were 7 major melt events where the temperature would jump, say, 8 to 10 degrees centigrade, 18 degrees Fahrenheit, rapidly, which would cause thousands of feet of ice to melt, and afterwards you get a freezing event, so it goes back up. But if you've got one of those major melt events, that would explain why the flood lasts 375 days. And there are 7 different dates that show up in the past ice age, running from 47,000 years ago to 86,000 years ago. I'm not sure which one of those it is, so conservatively I say Noah's flood 55,000 years ago to 120,000 years ago. A reasonable date is 60 to 90,000 years ago. But I think at one of those major melt events.
And you have for years been saying anybody who says they found Noah's Ark, don't believe them. That's preposterous for many reasons, which you talk
yes.
about in the book.
Yes.
Much as we would like someone to find Noah's Ark or a serpent with a voice box, with a larynx, a fossil. Okay, Adam and Eve, what's your best guess on when they were alive?
Well, the best scientific date we got is 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 100,000 years. We don't have a really good... It's because there's no radioisotope clock between 50,000 years ago and 250,000 years ago. We have to use indirect methods. And often in the literature, they give you the statistical error, but they don't give you the systematic error, which could shift things by 50,000 years up or down. So I actually argue we get a more accurate date from the Bible than we get from the scientific evidence. The Bible basically tells us God put Adam and Eve in the garden where 4 known rivers come together. 2 of those rivers still flow today. 2 were flowing during the last ice age.
Okay, so the Tigris and Euphrates are still flowing today.
Yes.
And you said the 2, what are they, Pisgah?
The Gihon and the Pishon.
Okay, those are mentioned in the scripture as flowing during the time of the Garden of Eden.
Right.
And when do we now suppose they ceased to flow?
When the ice age ended, they became dry riverbeds. You can see it with
satellite
imagery.
Which ice age? What time period?
The last ice age ended about 13,000 years ago.
Okay, so, but you're suggesting that the Tower of Babel and Noah's flood and Adam and Eve are way, way, way before that. But you are saying, in fact, we know those rivers ceased flowing 13,000 years ago.
They did. We also know where they come close together today is 200 feet below sea level. During the last ice age, it was above sea level because the sea levels dropped by 390 feet. So that was dry land, which tells us, according to the Bible, Adam and Eve were alive sometime during the last ice age, which puts us between 20,000 years ago and 120,000 years ago. But now that we've got good dates for Genesis 10 and 11, that tells us somewhere between 60,000 and 120,000 years ago. Still not very accurate, but way more accuracy than you get from the scientific record.
I'm still fascinated by the idea of human civilization that far back, because we have...
Well, notice Genesis 4 talks about metallurgy. What we've now discovered is that people living in the high northern latitudes, during the winter time, they would look for these black stones on the snow. And 1/4 of them were stainless steel asteroids. So they would pick up those stainless steel meteorites and cold forge them into advanced tools. So metallurgy goes way farther back than what you read in the textbooks about the Bronze Age and the Iron Age.
When I heard you speak in New York recently, I was fascinated by when you talk about a limited flood, a flood that does not cover the whole globe, but covers
a big region.
That part of the yeah. globe that was inhabited by human beings.
Right, right.
Okay. So does that help us understand what was on the ark? For example, you do not believe that koala bears were on the ark.
Right, because there was no people living in Australia at that time. So no need to flood.
But I've seen with my own eyes children's books.
Yes.
With koala bears on the ark. And you're saying that's not true.
No sloths either from Brazil.
No sloths from Brazil.
No penguins. No polar penguins. Bears.
Okay, so all of those creatures existed where they existed. What was wiped out and what was brought onto the ark?
That you get from the book of Leviticus. The only animals that can be irreparably damaged by human sin are the nephesh animals, mainly the birds and mammals that we can tame, that are in contact with humans and get damaged by their sin.
What do you mean by that? I don't get that.
Well, what you see in Leviticus is if a cow has a habit of goring other animals or people, the owner of the cow is to be addressed. If the cow continues in that behavior, the cow is to be killed and the owner of the cow as well. Basically putting the blame for that cow's behavior on the human. And for good reason, God designed these animals to serve and please human beings. And what brings pleasure to the human owner is that animal viciously attacking other animals and people. That's exactly how the animal behave. It's not that the animal's a sinner, it's that the animal's trying to please its human owner. I mean, we see that today with the mean dog syndrome. I mean, who owns mean dogs? Mean people. The dog is just trying to please its mean owner.
See, so this is one of those rabbit holes. We can't go down this rabbit hole. So the animals on the ark, so you're saying the flood did not extend to the Americas.
No.
And it seems, I think I remember from your book saying that it didn't extend to Europe.
Yeah, Europe was not yet inhabited. It's basically the Near and Middle East and possibly parts of Eastern Africa. That'd be the maximum extent of the flood. The minimum extent, you flood all of the Persian Gulf, all of Mesopotamia, the Persian or the Fertile Crescent, parts of Arabia and Iran. That's the minimum extent. So somewhere between those two, but enough to wipe out all of humanity and all these nephesh animals that are owned by humans.
And nephesh, you mean soulish?
Soulish animals, which would be the animals we can tame, basically birds and mammals. Now, if you actually look at the animals in that region, we're probably looking at maybe 200 or 300 pairs of animals on board the ark.
Okay, so that's another key piece.
Yes.
That if we're going to be logical, and we talk about the size of the ark cannot fit an infinity of animals.
Right.
And so you have done the math, and it checks out, basically.
Right.
You're saying that it makes sense that this many animals could have been on the ark.
You know, we're looking at 120 species of animals that could have been irreparably damaged by human sin, or animals that would be owned by Noah and his family that were protected from that sin. Those are the ones he took on board. And he said, for some, I want you to take 7 pairs, because those are the ones you need to launch civilization and to do your animal sacrifices. The rest of them, 1 pair is all you need.
So no tigers on the ark?
I don't think there are any tigers on the ark, but I do think there were lions on board the ark, because lions lived in that region at that time. And you know what? Lions make excellent pets.
So I've been told. But I just, again, I love the specificity and the clarity. You've thought about this, and you know, you're not just throwing stuff out that you don't know. You talk in the book, there's so much you've talked about in so many of your books. You mention Atlantis, lost civilizations. Again, this, I can't think of the guy's name who talks about this, but it's fascinating to me that we are so ignorant, really, of the world, let's say, you know, before 5000 BC or something like that. But there was so much. And it's interesting to me that you're telling me that the Bible implies that.
Yes.
That even if you didn't know what to think, you're saying the Bible implies that we have had...
We're actually now finding relics of human civilization when the sea levels were 50, 100, 200 feet lower than they are today. We have totem poles in British Columbia that talk about the rising of the sea level, which means those totem poles had to have been constructed 12,000 years ago, because that's when the floodwaters are coming up. That's actually the oldest written record in humanity.
12,000 years ago, a totem pole.
On totem poles,
you consider totem poles writing?
I do.
All right. I'll accept that. You talked about, I had to ask you about this. You don't talk about it in the book, but I remember when I first encountered your work, you talked about the fine-tuning of the universe, and I don't think I said it earlier, but it was your books that launched me on this decades-long quest to read other kinds of books, which ultimately led me to write Is Atheism Dead? Which, great book, you should think of getting a copy. But in that process, I remember reading about the concept of the fine-tuned universe, and for the first time encountering the thesis, which I now radically agree with, that there is zero chance that there's life popping up on other planets in the universe. Like, zero chance, not a slim chance. And if that's true, which it is, I think, clearly, then when we see what we call UFOs, those are not extraterrestrial aliens from other galaxies. And for the first time in reading your book all these years ago, I got an idea of what they might be. So what do you say these phenomena are? Or first of all, do you accept that there are such phenomena?
I do. I've written 7 books on fine-tuning. My wife is editing book number 8, and that book talks about UFOs and UAPs. And I got a chapter in there where I talk about how we astronomers have a mission to send spaceships to the nearest planet beyond our solar system. Because of the laws of physics, the biggest spaceship we can send, without being totally destroyed on the journey, is smaller than a matchstick. And even then, we have to send thousands of them. Because if you hit a tiny dust particle you can't even see, it'll penetrate several feet of armor plate. It hits that hard. And therefore, we have to send really tiny spaceships, thousands of them, to have any hope that one of them will miss getting hit by a dust particle. Which means this idea of Star Trek and Star Wars, where big spaceships go across interstellar space, we know that is impossible. That can't happen.
I mean, it can't happen for many, many reasons. And again, we don't have time to get into it. But then people say, well, then what are these things? Because you have people who are so
good
convinced
question.
That they're real, and I'm convinced enough that they're real. But then the question is, what are they? And I'll say, before I let you answer, I think most people would say, oh, they're coming from extremely advanced civilizations. They've been out there forever, and they're going to bring us technology and, you know, peace. And that's the story you hear over
and
over.
Well, that's the story I heard from Carl Sagan when I took a course from him. That was kind of his mantra.
You took a course from Carl Sagan?
Yeah, and Frank Drake as well. So they were kind of preaching this message. But it's like I was sitting there just saying, don't we already have an Encyclopedia Galactica? We don't need any information from these extraterrestrials. We already have it. Carl overheard me. He says, I know what you're talking about. Nobody can live up to the moral standard of that book. It's like, that's the whole message of the book. No one can live up to that moral standard without help from the Creator.
Carl Sagan intuited this from your...
Yeah, you overheard my comment.
Crack.
Yeah. But let me get back to these things, because we have over 2,000 documented cases where these UFOs go through our atmosphere, no sonic boom, no heat friction, even though they're traveling thousands of miles per hour. They crash into the Earth, a crater. You get a crater. If there's snow, the snow is melted. The vegetation is always damaged. But you go to the site, no debris, no artifacts. We all know what happens when an airplane crashes into the Earth. There's lots of stuff to find. This case is nothing. Mm. And in one Russian city, they had 30 of these incidents happening within an 18-month period. Now, what's interesting about that part of Russia, a lot of people were involved in the occult. In the occult, which is an attempt to get secret information or power from angelic beings. And that's the message of the Bible. God created 2 distinct species of intelligent life. We humans that are constrained by the physics of the universe, and angels who are not. So these 2,000 documented cases, I think we're being visited by beings who are not limited by the laws of physics. And what the Bible tells us, this only happens to people who are involved in the occult, trying to find power and information from these angelic beings. They need an invitation. And I made several speaking trips to Russia during the communist era. I was amazed at how many scientists were seeing these UFOs, because that was a time when the Soviet government was sponsoring research in occult physics. They knew they couldn't beat the West with our technology, but they thought they could beat us with occult physics. When I went back in 94, communism was no longer there. They shut down the occult physics departments. The number of scientists who were having these UFO encounters had plummeted. So
the Nazis, of course, were big into occult.
They were into it too, yeah.
Side, trying to get power from beyond this world. But you say angelic. When you say angelic, you don't mean unfallen angels. You mean fallen angels.
Fallen angels, because people have these close encounters with UFOs. It's 100% harmful. The best you're going to come away from with a close encounter is recurring, terrifying nightmares. Worst case scenario, you get killed by the phenomena. So it's never benevolent. It's always harmful. And really what these beings are trying to do is get people to end their life before they give their life to Jesus Christ. So animals have been killed. People have been killed. People claim to have gotten messages through these beings. There are times where the human contactee is put into a trance and begins to write stuff on a typewriter or a computer. You may have heard of the Arantia book. It's the Bible of UFO cults. 4,000 pages long. One-third of the content of the Arantia book is denying the deity of Jesus Christ. So that should be a clue where it's coming from.
Well, I think, I'm not clear who wrote the book, but it does seem like most people are ripe for a great deception, that we've all been catechized for decades that, oh yeah, life just pops up everywhere. It pops up on Earth, and it pops up, which is absolutely nonsense. But we've all been told that that's true, and therefore, it would be, we all know the phrase, it would be arrogant to assume that we're the only life. You know, people always say that. So there's this assumption that, well, sure, yeah, there's life out there, and here it comes, and we're going to find it. And you say very carefully, but very clearly, that it's demonic. And you're the first, I read it in your books for the first time. Although I have recently heard people say that, oh yeah, these are interdimensional beings. They start, yes, they start using this language.
Right.
Well, what does that mean?
Yeah, it means a being from dimensions beyond the universe, which is what the Bible talks about,
yeah,
angelic beings. So
I'm I'm so fascinated. All right, what other weird stuff can we talk about? All right, Atlantis, UFOs, Nephilim, Neanderthals. What do you make of, in other words, talk about the existence of hominids other than human beings. That's never something that's been clear to me. And that, again, a lot of people would think, oh yeah, we evolved, you know, from apes. What do you make of the fossil record of hominids, you know, way, way back?
Yeah, I believe it's reliable. We know there's at least 10, maybe 11 species of bipedal primates that preceded us human beings. And the first one's about 6 million years ago. Neanderthals and the Denisovans are the most recent. But what's brand new, we now know from the genetics of the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, their populations were never very high. The greatest number of Neanderthals ever existed at one time was 15,000, and probably less than 8,000. If that's the case, it explains why the bones of Neanderthals 400,000 years ago are the same as the bones that we see 45,000 years ago. With that tiny of a population, they can't evolve. You get the same story with the other 10 bipedal primate species. We see no evidence for evolution. Their technology never advances. the technology the Neanderthals had 400,000 years ago is the same they had when they went extinct. And with numbers that small, population numbers that small, it tells us there can't be any evolutionary link between us and the bipedal primates, or say the chimpanzees and the gorillas. The numbers simply don't support that.
But when we're talking about, you know, Denisovans, Neanderthals, what are we talking about? Are these cavemen? Are these apes that we fancy are somehow advanced? But what are we to make of
them? Well, Neanderthals, for example, walked on two legs. They were about as tall as we are, but had much more muscular structure, heavier bones, way more muscular. So they were definitely heavier than us. Their brains were about the same size as ours, but the brain had to manage a much bigger body. I mean, our ratio of brain mass to body mass is quite a bit higher. The other thing we've recently discovered, their brains were like a Coke can, cylindrical. Our brains are globular. We have a big parietal lobe. They don't.
Speak for yourself. But I mean, you can understand how people would say, this is very confusing. Why would God create these bizarre creatures?
Well, it was an atheist anthropologist, Ian Tattersall, that said, look, what I've discovered doesn't fit my model, but I think it fits yours. And what he was pointing out is this. Notice these bipedal primate species. We have no evidence for any of them in North America, South America, or Australia. We have the most evidence in Africa, a little more in Asia, and hardly any at all in Europe. They said, look what happened. When humans first went into Australia, they quickly drove to extinction 94% of the large-bodied bird and mammal species that existed there. North America, the extinction rates were 80% in South America, 73% in North America. When humans went into Africa, the extinction rate was only 4%. So what he was suggesting to us, I think your God created this sequence of bipedal primates that were bipedal and were using tools basically to train birds and mammals. When you see tall bipedals with weapons in their hand, run away. But notice God designed these animals to come to us, to relate to us. So what happened in Australia, instead of running away from the humans, they ran towards them and got wiped out. Same thing happened here in North America and South America. There were horses here, there were camels here, there were elephants here. They all got wiped out by the humans crossing over the Bering Land Bridge because they had no experience with dealing with bipedals.
There were horses in North America.
Yes, cows, horses, camels, and humans wiped them out. And therefore, the people living in North and South America, they never got out of the Stone Age. They lacked the animals they needed to launch and sustain civilization. Explains why the Aborigines were stuck in the Stone Age. They lacked the animals they needed to launch civilization. It didn't happen in Africa, didn't happen in Europe or Asia, because there the animals had been trained by all these bipedal primates, run away.
I mean, anybody else talking about this, I would just scoff and I would run away. But you, because I've read your stuff, I mean, you speculate with real wisdom, and it is amazing. It is just amazing to me that you're willing to speculate. I think that's the joy of learning, the joy of curiosity, saying let's just look at what we can find and what we can, you know.
Yeah, speculate, but put it to the test.
Yeah. Right. I was going to say, don't just throw out theories, but throw out theories, but then say, well, let's see, what is the...
What stands up?
So that in the fossil record in the Americas, we have record of horse-like...
Yes.
We do.
Yeah, camels, horses. Yeah, it's all there.
But this is going... So the Bering Strait, the land bridge was what, 15,000 BC or something like this?
The bridge was there for quite a long time, but it was too cold for humans to pass until about 17,000 years ago. So the first humans entered North and South America about 16,500 years ago. And they saw these big mammoth creatures. You kill one of those, you can feed a whole tribe for quite a while. And that's what happened. We wiped them all out.
In which book of yours do you deal with this issue that we're discussing now?
Well, some of it's in that book right there.
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah, another is in a book called Improbable Planet. I put some of that in there.
Yeah.
So then Navigating Genesis.
And most of this can be found at Reasons to Believe.
Reasons.org, yeah.
Reasons.org.
Yeah.
Reasons.org.
Right.
Okay, can you see why I'm tortured? I want to keep going and we're out of time. Please thank my guest, Dr. Hugh Ross, for this evening. If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.